Broadcasting to you live from Burnaby Mountain, BC, we are CJSF 90.1 FM, and we are diverse, independent, and yours.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded July 30th, 2025. Well, long before Donald Trump's invocation of media as fake news, the press was recognized as being bought, biased, and interested less in objective truths than the objectives of whomever was footing the bills. It was, to counter this correct public skepticism, publisher Joseph Pulitzer founded and funded a school of journalism at Columbia University, inaugurating the now famous Pulitzer Prize. But simply burnishing the yellow press hasn't removed the tarnish of partisan propaganda masquerading as honest reporting. And just as Pulitzer's and his contemporary Randolph Hearst's headlines are credited with stoking, if not starting, the Spanish-American War more than a century ago, today's media lies and half-truths allow wars based on false premises commence and perpetual ones smolder on. John Zatta is an author and journalist who worked many years at CBC Television News. He's worked in over two dozen countries as a journalist, including in the Middle East, filing for the Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera English, and BBC Online, among others. John's book titles are In the Valley of the Noble Beyond, In Search of the Sasquatch, which he describes as a travelogue investigating Sasquatch reports in small coastal communities in British Columbia, and Veils of Distortion, How the News Media Warps Our Minds. John Zatta in the first half. And European Union Commission President Ursula von der Leyen announced Sunday the preliminary agreement of a trade deal between the EU and the United States that would see the Europeans serve their essentials to the Americans while saying Danke for the privilege. Continental stocks sunk along with the euro on the news of what Trump called the biggest deal ever made and left member nations a scramble to frame national responses. John Helmer's a journalist and author who's spent decades living in and reporting from Russia. He's the principal behind the news website Dances with Bears and has, as well as serving as advisor to governments at the highest level, been a professor of political science, sociology, and journalism. Among Helmer's many book titles are The Man Who Knows Too Much About Russia, The Lie That Shot Down MH17, Skripal in Prison, and the recently released Skripal sequel, Long Live Novichok, The British Poison That Fooled the World. John's recent article at Dances with Bears, When Negotiation Fails, Try Bribery, When That Fails, Try Extortion, When That Fails, Force, chronicles Donald Trump's bully European weekend in Aberdeen. John Helmer and Europe rendering unto Caesar what is Caesar's in the second half. But first, John Zatta minding the media warp. Welcome to the program, John.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure. Of course, now, John, in Veils of Distortion, you write, quote, "The single greatest object lesson about the modus operandi of the news media and its impact on reality is in its relationship to Donald J. Trump and his presidency." Well, you wrote this book as Trump was exiting the scene. He was on his way out, leaving the world stage forever. That's what we thought or hoped, perhaps. What then, John, for those that missed it the first time around or just thought, okay, we don't have to think about this guy anymore, is that single greatest lesson again?
Well, you know, when I set out to write the book, it was very much the idea was to talk about, you know, my experiences in the newsroom and to basically write a book about newsroom culture or subculture, or, I mean, kind of almost look at it in an anthropological or a sociological sort of way, because it's that much of a phenomenon. So during my time there, my over decade at, let's say, this example of the CBC, Trump had come into office. And I mean, the one thing that I had experienced in the newsroom and everybody else did at the time, and I'm sure they're even experiencing it more so now, if not just as much, was the domination of the stories every day by his antics and whatnot. So, and I use him in the book as an example of sort of almost the example par excellence of the news media's preoccupations and motives, and especially at the newsroom level and at the news culture level, which is focusing on controversial, divisive stories that involve celebrities to stir outrage and emotion, excessive emotion, and ultimately to draw attention to itself. And I mean, it seems to me that Donald Trump is you know, the media's dream come true in that sense. It's sort of the ultimate story, the story that keeps on giving. And in a sense, they knew that. When I say they, I'm talking about sort of in aggregate the news media at large. I mean, there are instances of news media moguls talking about how important it was to cover him and to focus on him, and they had done so to such an extent even before he had become president that I'm certain, and I write this in the book, that they almost certainly helped bring him to power by legitimizing him and focusing on him to such an extent. And that's it was the celebritization. He was already a celebrity, but he was elevated to an even higher echelon of celebrity status by the focus on him. And I think that in a sense kind of encapsulates it for me. And when we worked on a day-to-day basis on his stories, I mean, there was nothing that he did. I mean, he didn't bat an eyelash. He didn't make a noise that wasn't covered in sort of ad nauseum, and often to the expense of so many other stories. I mean, I a lot of people don't understand how large of a pool there is of possible stories coming in from around the world. And I mean, now it's a lot of it through social media, but a little bit less so a few years ago. It was, you know, through the wire services, but he dominated basically the story. And probably another really quick point I just want to make about the Trump thing before we possibly move on, and that is that even though there is this kind of relationship between him and the news media, which is antagonistic, you know, they hate on him, most of them hate on him. He has his sort of supporters in the news. He hates on them, but in a way they're involved in this very complex, complementary sort of relationship and dance. I mean, they rely upon each other. They may be opposed at one level, but they're actually working in cahoots at another level. And there was a writer by the name of Daniel Boorstein who wrote a well-known book in the 1960s called The Image, and it was sort of about the rise of culture of superficiality in the United States. There's an amazing section in the book where he describes how Senator Joe McCarthy and the press corps at the time were similarly massively opposed, but in the same way were kind of working in conjunction with each other. And when you kind of read it, and if you didn't sort of see the Senator Joe McCarthy part, you would actually think they were talking about Donald Trump. So like that in a sense sort of encapsulated it for me.
Trump is kind of, he's an extreme example, and that symbiosis between he and the media that you describe could perhaps be understood that he is a creature of the media even before his political career. As you mentioned, he was already a celebrity. He was created by the media, and then his political career was created by the media. And I guess the beginning point Absolutely. Of that was this back and forth fight that he had going with Obama, President Obama, sure. and the humiliation that he apparently suffered. This is all very WWF. Of course, he honed his media skills there too, did Trump. But he's such an extreme example. Does it blow all other examples? Does it skew the reality of what media is? How about closer to home? How about our own erstwhile Prime Minister Trudeau, who was a media darling at first, at least? He came from, everybody knows the story. He's the scion of this country's political dynasty of a sort, not maybe Kennedy, but Kennedy-esque. Did the same kind of lessons apply to lesser animals like Justin Trudeau?
Well, I mean, I think definitely, for sure. And again, and we live in a celebrity culture, and even though we're talking about the news and we're talking about something which is sort of seen to be as something very serious and kind of almost sort of almost pseudo intellectual among certain people, and this kind of thing that is sort of held in higher esteem, in fact, I mean, especially at the television level, I mean, we're talking essentially about entertainment, right? So I mean, all of these characters and all of these personages, and you know, whether they are actors or, you know, musicians or politicians, they're all sort of treated kind of in the same way. And I think with Trudeau, throughout his career, and I mean, it anytime there was any kind of a scandal, when eventually after a couple of years, that sort of honeymoon period sort of ended, and then the media kind of turned on him a little bit, that was often treated as kind of like a soap operatic affair. Anytime, you know, his trips, his difficulties in trips to India, for instance, were, and I think that was sort of one of the first examples I remember in the newsroom where I think the sort of goodwill for him had kind of.
But that's the way the script goes, though, right? It has to be a roller coaster. As I recall, his first misstep was with the Aga Khan, and he accepted right. a free holiday in the Caribbean or some that's such right. because that's the right. Aga Khan was a great pal of his dad, and mm-hmm. and that shadow of his dad, whose own media experience was unique, at least in its time in this country, sure. the way sure. Pierre Trudeau, you know, doing somersaults on the trampoline or spinning pirouettes behind the back of the Queen in train and so on and so forth, you know, that you know, he was a megastar, a political megastar.
That it's true that did precede the India debacle, but then, you know, something I think something they got a taste of you know, beginning to poke at the PM, and I think they sort of began to really kind of run with it in that other example. But I mean absolutely, and that's what I wanted to really focus on the book, is that just this idea that especially with the television news component, where you're really relying on images, you're relying on sound. I mean, down to the very way the stories are produced, it's like you're sort of taught and told and encouraged to create everything in a sort of story format. And when I say story, I mean kind of almost in like an archetypal, ageless story sort of sense, where there is a villain, a hero, a victim, where things are very clear cut, and you know, they're cut and dry, they're black and white. The stories are made as simple as possible. They're even chosen for their simplicity. I mean, I think whenever there were any kind of stories that had a longer context or a larger context or had complexity to them, you know, things that would sort of happen suddenly in Africa, let's say, that involved like a lot of debt or whatnot, but that had to involve an explanation that went back in time, that involved many characters. Those sorts of things, in addition to the fact that Africa stories are just not really very popular, that sort of those are factors that stood against them. So what is in fact happening when you're watching, let's say, and there are people who, you know, the television environment has declined in recent years because of the internet, obviously. But I mean, still quite a few people watch, and including, you know, like elder people, family and friends and whatnot. And they just don't realize how much of a soap operatic formula is being used in these productions, and especially on stories that go on for days and weeks and sometimes even months, right? And that's
John,
the whole idea.
When you say that the stories from Africa aren't very popular, is this a case of a chicken and egg situation here? Why do you think that is the case, if it is the case? I'm not sure how to even define popular, but is this a case of, well, people in Canada, the media doesn't present contextualized stories about Africa, or even enough stories about Africa? If I watch, say, the BBC World News Service, there tends to be more stories about Africa and former English or British colonies, you know. So they have, in Britain, they've got a much better understanding of the geography and the political geography of Africa right. than the average Canadian, I would say.
Right.
But what is it? Is this a chicken and egg thing, where that stories, people aren't interested so much in stories about Africa because they're so ignorant of it, and it's such an odd thing for them to see?
Well, I think. I'm not so sure that there isn't interest. I mean, I'd always been one of the people in the newsroom to argue that we should do stories that audience are unfamiliar with. But I think it's the sort of idea that when you know, the managers, the people who sort of make the larger decisions day to day, have this idea on audience, what the audience wants, what the audience is interested in, what the audience is able to and not able to understand, which are all assumptions. And I think that given, you know, Canada is, we're not the UK. We didn't have an empire. We're not, you know, I worked at Al Jazeera for several months in the middle of sort of my larger sort of CBC window. And I mean, I got a period of a month where they assigned me just to Burundi, Like there was a civil war in Burundi, and it was a very different the way they approach it. Like their broadcast is global and it's sort of round the clock and they go to different time zones. And their whole premise is to bring sort of world news to the world. And but I think with Canada, it's we have this sort of very parochial just view on who we are and what we are. And it's a bit ironic because we're a multicultural society, or that's what how we see ourselves or call ourselves. But we seem to just not, at the CBC, it was just, you know, there, it just didn't really make the cut, and we just sort of avoided those sorts of things. So I think it's maybe a little bit more in terms of what broadcasters are envisioning their audience to be and what they think they want.
Well, if you just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with John Zatta. John is an author and journalist. He worked for many years, as he's describing, at CBC Television News. He's also worked in over two dozen countries as a journalist, including in the Middle East, filing stories for the Star, the Toronto Star, Globe and Mail, Al Arabiya, Al Jazeera, as you just mentioned, BBC Online, and others. His book titles are In the Valley of the Noble Beyond, In Search of the Sasquatch. He describes that as a travelogue investigating Sasquatch reports in small coastal communities right up here in BC, and Veils of Distortion, How the News Media Warps Our Minds, which is what we're covering today. John, when you say that Al Jazeera had you cover Burundi, did they send you to Burundi physically?
No. So I should probably clarify. I was working as a news writer and producer in their main studio in Doha. And so what would happen is that during their daily broadcast, they would have their in-studio writers and producers sort of working on that side to prep their coverage. And so it was interesting that when you would come in to work on any given week or two-week period, they would keep you stuck to one story so that you're not shuffling every day, as would happen, let's say, for example, at the CBC. And so that becomes your beat, basically, what they assign you for your sort of two-week rotation. And so I was actually working on the inside in conjunction with the local reporter who was in Burundi at the time, and it was usually someone from the country.
And that's an education. That's an education for you too, I'm imagining, or for any reporter that
absolutely
have to focus on one area.
It's something that I tell a lot of my friends and colleagues about, and just how fascinating it was, because they kind of throw you into the deep end and you have to basically figure everything out. And and it is a crash course, and I really quite appreciated it, because I mean, in contrast, and this is not to bash everything about CBC, but we are talking in this context, you would come in from day to day and you would have no idea what they would sort of give you or assign you, and sometimes there would be some back to back stuff, but it was a lot more unpredictable and less sort of organized in that way.
Well, it's difficult for a reporter anywhere to provide context to her audience when they don't have the context themselves. In your book, you know, and this is a big thing for me, giving background, doing longer form stuff. When I started out this program, I went to some media events, conventions, conferences, listened to CBC reporters and old timers in radio, which was my area, and they insisted that a 7-minute interview was the maximum that the Canadian human mind was able to process. And then they started jacking off or something. I don't know what they thought they did, but you talk about context in your book, and the idea of context being, it's not sexy. What's sexy is fear, keeping people ignorant and feeding them stories that engender a fear in them. That keeps them riveted to their dials, whether it's radio or TV.
Right. No, and I mean, I think anyone who works in this business, and especially for something like a national broadcaster, which, you know, receives subsidies and tax money and all this kind of thing, and is sort of slated to be this kind of, you know, the preeminent representative of the national, you know, national news media, like there should be greater knowledge of this. And I think, of these sorts of things that distort the audience's perception of reality, basically. And essentially that's why I wrote the book. After spending several years there, I began to sort of notice and see in living practice all of these sorts of, and what I call veils, these distorting veils that happen in the news production process, affecting all the stories as they're being produced along the production line, basically. Like, and these are things, some of them are things we all know, like filtering and exaggeration and you know lack of true objectivity. And when I talk about objectivity, I don't mean objectivity as neutrality or as giving equal weight. It's just, I think there's a kind of more nuanced idea of objectivity as seeing as many sides to a story as possible, just to get a general impression of its complexity, basically. And of course, storytelling, the storytelling mind, human nature, we want sort of certainty, we want simplicity, we want things we can understand. There, those sorts of tendencies do not make for true objectivity in the sense that I just described. Basically, there's not enough time for it. It's too complicated, and things like rushed work in the newsroom, bringing in people who are, generalists rather than true experts. Like, all of these things combine together to basically kind of create this image of the world that isn't, actually the lived experience of it in a bigger sense, in a sort of wider sense. And I think. In a way, like, news workers kind of work in ignorance when they don't know about these sorts of things. And that's kind of why I wrote the book. I kind of wrote it for my colleagues as well. And not many of them, read it, I don't think. And I didn't really get much of a reaction after having sort of quit my job in protest and then kind of releasing the book a few weeks later. But
what did you quit your job in protest of?
Well, I mean, it wasn't an actual stated protest. I think it was sort of more, I was sort of done with the place and I was about to release this sort of book and I didn't, I wouldn't have been able to stay at my job there.
This is CBC you're talking about?
This is CBC, yes, I'm sorry.
I am a fellow CBCer, but not in the same department as right. you. And I left in a bad way, too, because the culture there was awful. It was an awful culture. The management culture was terrible. I've worked at worse places since, though. CTV, I'm looking at you. But we're fast running out of time, John. And there's so much more to go over. I read a fact from a few days ago that 232 journalists have been murdered in Gaza since October 7th, 2023. That is by far in a so-called war zone, which I disagree with the semantics of that to begin with, but that's another story. But that this is more than all the journalists killed in all the wars going back past the Second World War and into this century of warfare. And when journalists became targets, and that was, as I recall, during the Iraq War in 2003, the Americans... an American tank aimed its turret at the Palestine Hotel in Baghdad.
Yep.
And deliberately killed three. Well, they deliberately fired a tank shell into a hotel room that they knew was occupied by international. The hotel was occupied by international journalists, and they could see, though they denied it, that there was guys with a camera on the balcony filming what was going on with their invasion of the city. That was a deliberate murder. And now that there's been many murders even before October 7th of journalists. What about that sense of collegiality? Why? I thought when the Palestine Hotel was struck, the journalists, I was a much younger man. I thought journalists around the world would be outraged that they would, even if they didn't say anything when it happened in Yugoslavia, when the Americans blew up TV stations, that they would come out and say, this blatant act of murder cannot stand and journalists cannot be made targets. Otherwise, how will the people know anything? How will we find out anything? And it didn't happen. What's your take, to use the cliche, on your colleagues' silence, the dogs that wouldn't bark?
Because I did spend a bunch of time in the region, among, Arab journalists and Westerners who worked in their midst there. I mean, I guess it's maybe perhaps my feed. I do get quite a bit of, protest and feedback and mention of these sorts of things. But I guess you're asking more kind of in the general sense. And I guess the answer would be, well, and it kind of comes down to sort of every sort of, you know, major political issue or war or injustice, or, I mean, there's a lot of things that go by the wayside in these conflicts and, you know, the truth and aspects of the war itself kind of are not just, so much is not mentioned, basically. I mean, if you look at Jazeera's coverage versus anyone here, basically, who does periodic coverage of the war, I mean, you have basically kind of a full slate, a full comprehensive coverage of everything that's going on there. So I don't know. I think it's the distance, perhaps it's indifference, it's not wanting to know. It's like anything else, looking the other way. And because I suppose to wade into those waters is to wade into controversy, right? So and that's probably it, I would say. I don't know. I mean,
well, it's always
Go ahead.
Oh, well, I was going to say that it's my there's people that run towards the fire and there's people that run away from it, you know, and that it was always my assumption, and my interest in journalism personally was inspired by those people that run towards the fire, and they do so because they think it's their duty to help. And the fact that journalism has become just a career vehicle and not public service, as you mentioned in the book, is, I believe, at the heart of the great disappointment of the entire field. But it's also the promise that what is replacing the CBC, whose viewership is going down, not just because of the internet and the even worse competitors that they have in this country, and the same goes for abroad too, is because of that abrogation of civic duty and the rejection of the truth to be replaced by mealy-mouthed one-sidedness, or both-sidism, I should say, that is the real problem. It's an interesting book, John, Veils of Distortion, How the News Media Warps Our Minds. John Zada is the author, that's Z-A-D-A. Where do people get the book, John?
It's pretty much available at every online storefront. So it's up. It's depends on the person's choice, basically.
Perhaps the next time we can talk about the Sasquatch, because that's right up my alley and right around the corner from me. I'm still waiting to see my first one. But thanks a lot, John, for coming on. And I want everyone else to stay tuned. After the break, I'm going to be joined by John Helmer. We're going to talk about what this deal in Europe, that the big, beautiful deal that the big, beautiful Orangeman says he's signed with them to everybody's cost by the looks of it. Thanks again, John.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire. Fire.
If you travel around Europe today, you'll find societies stratified. You'll find an ever-widening political divide. You'll find a growing left and a right that's growing faster, convincing people they're the ones to avert the next disaster. You can see the dark clouds growing, taking over every space, except, oddly enough, in a little place called England, where a growing chorus screams, I agree. The BBC ignored him, or they treated him like a clown. Transnational corporations said, this man will bring us down. The Blairites in the party stabbed him in the back, and then they did it again. But after each attack, he was steady at the helm, at the job for which he was picked, despite all the accusations. He's an anti-Zionist peacemaker who wants to change.